Chapter 8. Numa Vessel Raleigh, on station outside the fire zone. Kurt had shed the firefighting gear, showered, and thrown on some jeans and a Numa t-shirt. Never had normal clothes felt more comfortable. He made his way to the sick bay, where the ship's doctor checked his hands and found them to be burned, something Kurt could have told him without all the poking and prodding. "Nothing too bad," the doctor said. "Just first degree. Don't high-five anyone for a few days, and you'll be fine." After applying some Silvadine cream, the doc released him, and Kurt met up with Joe, Captain Brooks, and Rick Cox at the command and control center for the Raleigh's dive teams, a compartment the crew referred to as Oslo. The acronym stood for Off-Ship and Land Operations. The crew pronounced it like the name of the Norwegian capital and referred to it that way, too. "Meet you in Oslo for the briefing. Where have you been all day? Stuck in Oslo?" From here, a project leader could monitor the status of crew members and submersibles conducting dives or landside operations. Screens around the room could display images beamed in from helmet-mounted cameras, ROVs, and anything else Numa used. Sonar images, including those relayed from other ships, buoys, and sleds, could be combined into one coherent picture and presented on the centerpiece of the room, a 3D virtual display that its designers called a holographic presentation chamber. The crew of the Raleigh called it the fish tank because it was the size of a billiard table and, when turned off, appeared to be nothing more than a huge block of frosted glass. Once turned on and supplied with sonar data, it created a miniature three-dimensional view of whatever area was under observation, including accurate positions and scales of any divers, submersibles, reefs, wrecks, obstructions, and surface ships in the sonar area, all in incredible detail. Looking into the tank from above provided a top-down view. Moving around to any of the sides gave the observer a side-on view and allowed the project manager to gain a big-picture understanding of any operation that was being conducted. He walked in to find Joe, Brooks, and Cox studying several wall-mounted screens at the far end of the compartment. The first screen was displaying the ongoing fire as viewed from the masthead cameras. Another showed them a satellite view of the Gulf, with the pall of smoke that was drifting eastward. A third screen displayed a map of the Gulf, showing the positions of every active drilling rig, capped wellhead, and pipeline in the area. The arrangement looked like a mess of tangled string. A fourth screen showed the grim faces of two men in Washington: Rudy Gunn, who was Numa's assistant director and second in command, and Lance Alcott, the head of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Alcott was talking as Kurt walked in. "And the Coast Guard is sending 5 ships to help fight the blaze, but until they arrive, the president has put Numa in charge. A decision that makes no sense to me, but there you have it." Alcott shot Rudy a sour look. Rudy ignored him completely and took over the conversation. "First order of business is to assess the damage." Captain Brooks had already done that. "We've circled the fire zone, studying the surviving rigs and scanning the waters below with sonar. We have a full picture of the destruction. The pipeline network is damaged and venting gas. The Alpha Star is a total loss. She won't be on the surface much longer. The other 2 rigs are in better shape. The crews are safe. But the platforms are in danger. They remain surrounded by fire, though not directly ablaze at the moment." Rudy looked toward Cox. "Your company was hoping we could save the other platforms." "They cost almost $1 billion each," Cox replied. Rudy nodded. "So I've heard. We're sending a pair of ocean-going tugs to drag them out of danger. But looking at the video, I don't see any hope of getting a line on either one unless the fire is dampened down." "That's unlikely," Cox said. Alcott had a suggestion. "We're sending tankers to latch onto the outer wellheads. They'll draw some oil and gas off to decrease once venting. That might reduce the flames." "Might as well turn the tankers around," Kurt said. "They'll only get in the way." The head of FEMA bristled at that suggestion. "We found them useful in the Deepwater Horizon incident. Kept 2 million barrels of oil from hitting the Gulf waters." Kurt looked toward Cox. "Maybe you should tell them." Cox stood and cleared his throat. "There isn't any oil coming to the surface." Alcott looked shocked. Even Rudy tilted his head as if he hadn't heard correctly. No oil? Just flammable gas, Cox said. They can still snap onto the outlying wellheads and draw some of that gas up, even if they simply flare it off. It's not natural gas, Kurt said. Nor is it methane or any other type of hydrocarbon that I've ever seen. It's reacting with the water, burning on its way up. Dousing it spreads and thins it, but does nothing to extinguish it. Alcott sat back, looking flummoxed. That makes no sense. I've never heard of a gas that burns while submerged in water. Neither have we, Kurt replied. So I spoke with Paul Trout, our chief geologist. He suggested two possibilities. Either the ruptures are venting oxygen vapor along with the hydrocarbons, or we're dealing with a previously undiscovered compound. All we can be sure of is that the gas is hydrophoric, meaning the fumes ignite spontaneously when they make contact with the water. Makes it even harder to imagine towing the rigs to safety, Rudy said. Kurt nodded. We'll work on it and let you know. Rudy and Alcott signed off, and Kurt glanced at Brooks. Let's see what we're up against. He walked over to the fish tank and turned it on. The lights in the room dimmed as the hologram came to life. The seabed appeared first, depicted in olive green. Then orange lines crisscrossing revealed the locations of the submerged pipelines. Finally, vertical red lines appeared, representing 1,000-foot lengths of pipe string, which led up from the seafloor toward icons representing the oil platforms at the surface. Let me add the fires, Kurt said. He tapped a few more keys, and soon columns of purple and white could be seen traveling vertically from breaks in the orange pipes. They spread out as they rose upward and bloomed on the surface like giant, deadly flowers. Each fire is coming from a different pipeline, he said, looking at Cox. The main fire is here, venting upward through the wellhead you and your crew drilled. It's hitting the surface directly under what's left of the Alpha Star. The three-dimensional image showed the Alpha Star engulfed in purple. Kurt turned the image slightly, and it was easy to see that the other platforms were ringed with fire and getting toasted from the outside, but not sitting directly over the flames. Cox moved closer and squinted into the projection chamber. His bloodshot eyes were wide. We use a lot of high-tech junk when we're looking for oil, but I've never seen anything like this. He scratched his head and studied what he was looking at. No one knew what lay below the rigs better than him. Those other fires are coming from the field collection lines, he said, pointing to small sections of the orange pipe. There's no way to shut them off. They lead directly to the main well. Joe leaned closer. He was an engineer. He'd built submersibles and subsurface aquatic habitats and had even worked on an oil rig in his youth. He pointed to an area where the orange pipes merged. If we closed the transfer valves here, that would block the flow of gas to the fires near the other rigs. In theory, Cox said, but the controls to operate those valves were on the Alpha Star. Can we do it in person? Joe asked. Cox shook his head, and all four men went back to studying the fish tank. Finally, Kurt had an idea. We can't put the fires out, and we can't move the rigs. But what if we move the fires? Cox looked Kurt's way. How exactly does one move a fire? Kurt pointed out the largest pipe that was still intact. It led back to a spot directly beneath the burning wreckage of the Alpha Star. If we cut the pipe here, the gas that's venting near the other rigs will escape here instead of at the other ruptures. What's left of the Alpha Star will take the full brunt of the fire, but the rest of the Inferno should die on the vine. With the other two platforms free of the flames, you can tow them out and they should end up no worse than blackened Cajun chicken. Cox leaned closer, studying the arrangement, and then walked around to the far side so he could see it from the reverse angle. There, he dropped down and gazed into the fish tank like he was staring at lost treasure. Sacrifice the ruined platform to save the others, he said. I could sign off on that. But if this gas does what you say it does, if it detonates the instant it contacts the water, then you're going to get an enormous blast when you cut into that pipe. Knowing what it did to our rig, I wouldn't want to be anywhere near that line when it goes. Kurt nodded. Then we'll use explosives and blow it remotely.